Welcome, everyone, to episode 429 of Signals from Mars. I'm your host, Victor. And for this episode, we welcome in the Nashville band, Howling Giant, Tom, Sebastian. They're here to talk about all things about the band, new album, so on and so forth. You know, I'm going to throw some left field questions at them as well. So that's next.
I'm ready.
Let's do it.
Quick reminder that in addition to hosting Signals from Mars, I've also worked behind the scenes helping other podcasters. With over 16 years of experience and more than 1,200 episodes that I've produced or appeared on, I offer podcasting editing, ghost hosting interviews, and repurposing content into viral clips, show notes, transcripts, and social media posts. If you've got a podcast and need help making it sound professional, or if you want to turn your episodes into content that actually grows your audience, I can help. Check out the podcasting services page over at signalsfrommars.com. Just go all the way to the right on the menu. You'll see work with me, hover over that, and you'll see podcast services and sponsorship. Let me help you make your podcast stand out. Speaking of sponsorships, Signals from Mars is sponsored by listeners like you and also by great sponsors. If you've got a brand, product, or service that connects with rock and metal fans, I'd love to work with you. Our audience isn't casual. They're collectors, concert goers, and gear buyers who support the bands and brands they love. Sponsorship packages start at just $150 a month and include on-air mentions, social media plugs, and even product features. If you want to connect with a loyal rock and metal audience, head on over to the sponsorship page on signalsfrommars.com to learn more. Quick shout out here to my patrons. Want to say hey to Sean Richmond, Tony Espin, Anthony Mackey, Ed Ferguson, Johan Edstrom, Metal Dan, Chris Vaglio, Gabriel Ruiz, Mark Striegel, Brad Dahl, Mike Jones, Jeremy Weltman, Steve Hoker, and Steven Saylor. Thank you guys for all of your support. And if you're wondering what Patreon is all about, just go to patreon.com/signalsfrommars, or you can also go to signalsfrommars.com and click on the support link and find out various ways that you can support the show, whether it's Patreon, whether it's PayPal, whether it's merch. Also want to thank all the uptick in people that are coming in and checking the show out. Because of the shorts that I've been posting on various different platforms, I've gone from having a little over 35,000 views back in July. July is when I went on vacation, where I started checking a lot of that stuff out. And currently over 125,000 views. Now, listen, there are a lot of people out there with gold videos and silver videos and platinum videos and this and that, which is displayed behind them, you know, when you see their live shows or whatnot. So 125,000 views in the grand scheme of things is still pretty small. But man, for me, it's a big deal. I've been doing this since 2009 and seeing that people are still checking the show out, still giving their feedback on these various different platforms like TikTok and YouTube and Instagram and so on and so forth. The journey's been fun. Also, you guys are going to see an uptick in interviews like you do with this one. So hopefully you guys enjoy the ride so far. And if you're new, Buckle in. Hope you guys enjoy this one. Welcome one and all to the latest episode of Signals from Mars. I'm your host, Victor, and joining me today are Tom and Sebastian from Howling Giant. On the day that this is released, their new album, Crucible in Ruin, will be released. How you guys doing?
Doing good, man. Thanks for having us.
Excellent. Thanks for coming on. And you guys are from Nashville. And have been around for quite a bit. How has the city changed, the music scene changed within the city from when you guys started to what it's like today?
You know, the guys moved down here, I think, in, I believe in 2008, 2010, something like that. Or no, I was here before them. But yeah, the music scene has changed a little bit. You know, country scene is always super big here. It's like the main tourist attraction. So that's kind of what everybody thinks when they're coming to Nashville. There is a huge underground, scene here, especially in the hard rock and heavy metal scene. And I'd say over the past, you know, 10 or so years that we've been, down here, that it's been really growing, and getting really popular. We have our friends in Friendship Commanders who just put out a record, and it is awesome. And so they're pretty big and picking up steam around here for sure.
Okay. Yeah. Well, one of the reasons for my question was I'm actually watching a old HBO show called Tremé. And part of what's going on in that show is they're based in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And with the city kind of changing over, more money coming into the city and whatnot, some of the like music areas are being gentrified. So you have people that are coming in that don't want music.
Yeah.
But they're, yeah, you know.
I think we're seeing that to a certain degree in Nashville as well. I know there are a lot of things that, you know, maybe are positive, and, you know, Seabass mentioned a few with our friends, but in reality, there's a lot of change in Nashville. There's a lot of money coming in, and a lot of these neighborhoods have been changing. When we first moved down here in 2013, Zach and I, there was a big like house show scene, specifically in like Murfreesboro, just outside of Nashville. It was this really cool, like underground, like punk and hardcore thing. And we kind of came in right near the tail end of that. So we kind of came into this, like, I don't want to say like the very end, but there was a bit of this punk rock, kind of southern rock, just like everyone bringing this like basement show, garage band energy to it. There were more dive bars, it felt like, that were hosting these like heavy kind of shows. Mm-hmm. So over the years, you've had people come in and like change a lot of these bars. When we started, there was a bar called Foo Bar, and it was amazing. It was in East Nashville. It eventually changed to Cobra, which is still there today, and Cobra is still cool. But I think those first few years, there was almost this like Wild West kind of attitude of like just things, you know, anything could happen at some of these shows. So still positive. There's still some DIY venues, but you know, it's kind of changed its face quite a bit over a decade.
Okay. Mm-hmm. How do you guys feel the city has influenced you guys as musicians?
Well, I mean, when you're constantly, you know, when you're in a city that's completely surrounded by music all the time, you know, that's definitely going to have an impact on you, no matter what kind of music it is. For instance, I feel inspired at I work at a venue, and I feel inspired almost every single night that I work there. And it's mainly bluegrass or country or rock and roll or R&B musicians, not necessarily anything heavy or, you know, metal. But yeah, just always being around just music in general is just going to have that. It's going to give you that inspiration to want to continue to write and perform.
Yeah, I think, at least speaking for myself, I have a lot of friends who are involved in like kind of pop music and like writing country music. And hanging out in those circles, you learn about this like art of songwriting for them. And I think that before I moved here, I approached writing music, especially for Howling Giant, as this kind of sprawling, like through written idea. There wasn't necessarily like a consciousness about song form in the early days. Mm-hmm. And after hanging out and kind of learning this craft of like pop songwriting, like where would a verse chorus go? What's the purpose of a bridge? When would you include like a pre-chorus? These kind of fundamental like pop song forms. That's something Nashville's known for. And I think that's something we've been able to use in Howling Giant in like the heavy scene to kind of infuse some of that. I don't want to say catchiness, but I think I've learned a lot from that. And that's really what Nashville kind of brought to the table for me.
Oh, I would say that there's definitely catchiness in what you guys do. I mean, it's funny because there's the way that it's always set up, you know, stoner band, doom band, this, that. But I think what separates you guys is that catchiness, is the melodies to go along with the riffs to kind of, you know, separate you guys from the rest of the pack.
Man, I appreciate that. Yeah. I think that there's value in like all these different ways to write a song. You know what I mean? And the right move isn't always to make you know, like a pop song form. Yeah. But I do think that it's powerful, and being conscious of like how many times can you repeat a section and evolve it? How many times can you, you know, try and really establish a motif before it's time to move on and like change that expression? Right. I think it's just like, you know, it's something you don't need to do every time, but it's good to be conscious of that. And it's something we're trying to keep learning more about. You know what I mean? So,
right.
And also using those tools can help us, you know, expand our reach a little bit more within the fan base, because, you know, not everybody is going to like, you know, stoner rock or stoner metal as much as we do, or, you know, not everybody's going to like prog rock or prog metal, you know, whatever. And so to have those little instances where we kind of put a touch of that sort of pop arrangement in, can help bring new listeners in and you know, help expand their, you know, what they listen to, really.
Yeah, absolutely. With Crucible and Ruin now being your third full length, and obviously with all the other EPs that you guys have released, did you guys have any set goals before going in to record the album, things you wanted to try, maybe a little different than what you'd done before, whether that's sonically with how the album sounded, whether that's with the songwriting, or maybe, as you just said, Sebastian, maybe adding certain elements that maybe you hadn't in the past to parts of the album?
Yeah, I think that, you know, with every release that we have, we're always looking to try something new and try, you know, to add new parts and add a new element to our sound. Specifically, the thing that stands out for me for this record was the fact that we got to work with Neil Turi at Amish Electric Chair Studios up in Athens, Ohio. And he just has an amazing place up there. And really, this was our first time actually stepping into a full recording studio, because in our past releases, we've done a lot of DIY stuff. You know, a lot of stuff has just been done at home, and we've been happy with the sound that we've been getting, but it's a total different experience when you're actually walking into a studio and you have a set 2 weeks of you know, hey, I have to get this done. We have to get this done in 2 weeks, or that's it. So it kind of puts a pressure on you a little bit, but the quality of gear and just Neil and his experience that he has has just made the whole thing really enjoyable. So.
Cool. Yeah, I think just to expand on that, you know, we knew going into this record, we wanted it to feel like a step up from a production standpoint. That was kind of like the main goal. Spinning off from that, I think we started adding other elements that we wanted to try differently, Notably, you know, we leaned more on creating like guitar layers and a little less on the like organ element that was on previous records. We still wanted to have some synth moments, but we wanted to bring in this fourth member, Adrian, who's been amazing, and being able to lean on him with like dual guitar parts and lean on him for these kind of post-rock, you know, tendencies that he has with some of the synth layers. We thought that could give kind of a different character to this record. So it wasn't just another, not a cookie cutter Howling Giant record, but we wanted it to just feel very much like a different flavor. And I think being able to go to the studio with both Adrian on board and working with Neil Turry, like Seabass said, it was just kind of a completely different environment than we have used in the past. So from that, it really kind of brought out some really cool characteristics of our songwriting that maybe have been there before, but didn't get the same like attention and spotlight that they were able to get at Amish Electric Chair Studios.
Yeah. And that makes sense. Cause I listened to the new album a few times today, and I went back and listened to Glass Future as well. And it definitely sonically sounds like an upgrade. Being a wannabe musician and having dabbled in things like Superior Drummer and stuff like that, right away when somebody releases an album, I can tell, all right, well, they're using samples from this package or that package. And honestly, with Crucible and Ruin, it sounds like you guys recorded everything in a studio. It sounds it sounds like this could have been released in any decade without like those technological markings.
I'll say with like Glass Future, you know, I'm really proud of that record, and especially the songwriting I really love from that record. And I think what I really dig about Glass Future was that we were able to do all of that DIY and get an album that sounds great. It does sound like it was done at home with kind of the limited means, but it almost has a character from that. And for me, it really feels like a timestamp. We've always wanted to use real drums since you brought that up. We aren't a band that wants to use samples ever. So you're kind of held, not handcuffed, but what you have to record with, the mics in the room, have a huge impact. And going into the studio with Neil, we were like, man, I want it to have that bigness without being crazy compressed or just like punched in with these like drum samples. So the way that was achieved really was like taking extra time up front to like, you know, tune those drums very specifically so they could cut against the guitars and the tunings we were in. So we would be playing together and Neil would be in the room, you know, like just listening and like tuning so that they were sitting in kind of different areas where they weren't going to compete with like some of these like guitar and bass frequencies. So kind of taking that care and using the quality of mics and just his expertise in general, I think achieved that like bigness you can get from samples without having that like stamped on the top kind of, you know, I say fake, but like, you know what I mean? It was, really just found their home. And I think that takes an expert like Neil to be able to do that with a band like us, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a lot of times though, I mean, let's be honest, you're left to your devices and what you guys really can afford to work with. I mean, if the previous album needed to be worked on that way.
Yeah. Well, it's like you kind of have to check the scale and see how it's balanced. In the past, you know, we recorded Black Hole Space Wizard Part 2. We saved up enough money to buy like one 12-hour session in a studio in Nashville. I think it was called Q Division or maybe County Q, one of those two, something Q. But that took like, we had to save up so much money for that one session. And really the only goal was like, we just want to capture drums in this room. And I'm really happy with what we got there too, but that was a scramble. Like one day trying to get what you needed. So I think with the later records, you know, Space Between Worlds and Glass Future, we said, okay, I think the songs will be served better if we can be more comfortable and have the time it takes to get the right part, even if the sound quality is maybe not as good as like if it was in a studio. So for this time in Crucible and Ruin, being able to say, hey, we have you know, we have the parts, we have the time, and we have the space. I mean, it was like, that's the way we want to be doing things moving forward, I think. And you could really feel that while tracking. It was like, man, this is a whole different ballpark, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's not taking anything away from anything that you guys have done in the past. I think you mentioned it already. You guys are recording an album. So an album is like a photo album where you're taking a snapshot in time. It's just done sonically. Yeah. And whenever you guys are hearing this, you guys are going to remember we were here, we recorded on this gear, we did that, you know, so it's always going to bring you guys back. And
I think it's cool as a listener too, to be able to experience that, to like, if you've been following us from the beginning, each release has a different flavor. You know, it's not like a band where it's this kind of cookie cutter sound every time. And I mean, that's great if you have super high quality stuff, but it is kind of cool to be able to hear the evolution of a band with each record, both in songwriting style and, you know, the access that you have from a recording standpoint. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I don't know what that means for the next release. I'm trying to think, what do we do to level up? I just got to shred more, maybe. That's it. Get some more sweet picking on the record, you know? Yeah.
Is there any gear you guys got to use on this album that you hadn't used in the past that really kind of stood out to you guys personally?
Specifically for me, I'm not too much of a pedal guy. I usually keep things pretty simple. But I used the Aguilar Tonehammer DI on this record.
Well, you also used that sick Ampeg that our buddies. Well,
I used the Ampeg SVT right into a 810 cab. And then I was switching between a P bass and a J bass, both of which Neil had up there, and they just sounded awesome. But yeah, as far as like effects, we threw in a couple. I think we tried some fuzzes here and there for bass. But really the Aguilar Tonehammer just brought that extra crunch that we really needed.
Well, it's interesting with like bass tones. You know, I'm such a guitar head where like when I'm going into a studio and we as a band are trying to listen for like, what should the bass sound like? It's one of those things where it's like, man, this isn't my usual element, but also we don't have the usual biases. So we were able to kind of like listen with kind of like a very fresh set of ears. And even though it's a simple combination with like the SVT and the 810, it's like having access to a live room sound and be able to pair that with, you know, I usually hate DI bass, but the Tonehammer really did like sound sick. I was like, man, honestly, this blended with that room sound created that perfect balance of like the clarity we needed out of Seabass, while still having some of that like actual feel and thump. So it's not just like this kind of thin, you know, limp noodle kind of sound. You know what I mean? it was the right balance, and yeah, it sounded sick. From a guitar standpoint, I just used all the stuff that I brought. I tracked most of it with my Rocker Verb 100 paired with my PV5150, which was a cool kind of blend of those two. I guess this was kind of the record where I discovered Splawn amplification. Adrian brought his Splawn competition, which is like a 50-watt, like hot-rodded Marshall kind of sound.
Okay.
And man, it was sick. It was so sick that I was like, I bought my own. I bought a 100-watt version of that amp, which is now kind of the amp I'm using mostly. But really, it was like those three amps, which are just three different flavors of kind of a high-gain thing. And, you know, not a huge difference maybe on the record, but a huge difference in feel and response while tracking these things.
Okay.
As far as other like recording gear, I don't really know exactly what Neil was using, to be honest with you. The mics were nice. I don't really know what they were, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
As far as your personal gear to go out and play shows, what's your go-to gear?
Man, for me, it was always in the past, my orange Rocker Verb. That was an easy one because it was so available for backlining. And I do love that amp. It's kind of a standard. But lately, there's been a big shift, especially between me and Adrian, using like hot rodded Marshall tones. He's using a Freedman BE-100, which is so sick. And I'm using the Splawn QR-100, which is, you know, just a very slightly different kind of flavor of that same, like, you know, hot rodded, way over the top gain. If you want it, a lot of punch and clarity. I think with two guitars, it gives you that like bite and that chunk that just feels awesome. So that's for me, that's mainly what I'm using right now.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I've been rocking with, I just got a new bass from Vintage. They are a company based in the UK. It's pretty much a P bass style with a PJ pickups in it. And thing just sounds awesome. And I've been playing it through a Orange Obi-Wan 500 rack mount amp. That thing is killer. And then just using that through a Ampeg, was it 610? And yeah, man, that thing just sounds killer. I used to have the, you know, the full SVT and the 810 rig, and you know, we'd lug that around and do the live shows, but it just gets to be too much. It's just way too heavy and too much, you know,
the
takes up too much space
sick,
in the end.
But it's amazing how switching down to a 610, just like
it
in the van,
sounds awesome.
Still sounds big, and it makes a lot of room, especially with Adrian on board now. We're both playing 412 half stacks, right? So I'm bringing my Mesa oversized 412. I think he just got a Freedman 412 he's about to use. So it's, you know, it's a lot of amps. I would double it if I could, though. Get the full stacks out there, you know? Someday. Got to get the trailer first.
Yeah.
It's funny you say it's heavy. I wasn't sure if you meant heavy in that it weighed a lot or if it was giving you the exact...
Well, both, both. Really. It's
both, for sure.
It's tone per pound, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Look, the thing that those 810s sound so great, but when you're at the tail end of a tour and then the next venue, you have to climb up, you know, right, two flights of steps. It's just not, you know, it's just not worth it.
Yeah, I've had my fair share of carrying drums in the rain, so I hear you.
Dude, yeah, that's a thing.
Sebastian, you weren't the original bass player in the band. What drew you to the band?
So I actually wasn't, and I hope this doesn't come across as bad, but I wasn't super familiar with the band before I joined. I had heard the name before. And I know that they did a few shows around Nashville and just, you know, just, I just heard it through the, heard them through the grapevine, really. But then it just happened by chance that, I was at a specific time I had left a previous band and I was just kind of looking for, you know, for something, for anything. And, Tom showed up to the bar that I worked at and, you know, just kind of randomly by chance, he said, "Hey man, we're looking for a bass player. Why don't you just come and, you know, try it out and just check it out." And I was at that kind of point where, you know, after not being a band for about a month, I was kind of itching to get back into it. And so I just immediately said, yeah, without even really checking out the music, you know? And then I, of course, from there, I checked out the music and I was like, okay, this is the right decision. This is the, you know, the right way
so
to
this
go.
This is
so.
Where I was impressed with Seabass. I don't know. It was one of two things. Either A, our music is like super easy to just like wing it, or Seabass did his homework and knew all the parts. Because you showed up to the first practice and sounded sick. And I'm like, man, I don't know which one it is. Maybe our music's too easy. We got to make this tough. But yeah,
I'll be completely honest. I was listening to the songs as I was driving over there.
And that was enough. That was all
that
you
was
needed.
Enough. That was enough, man.
You stepped in, and I think at the time you were playing like that five string blue Warwick bass, or
yeah,
whatever that was.
Yeah, I had a
which was like
Warwick.
Kind of a hilarious vibe, but it also was like sick, dude. That's a flex. Guy shows up to the first practice with the big old five string blue bass, like it's a move.
It was dope as hell. And then I moved to I started using a Sandberg. They are a German company. It was pretty much, again, a P-bass style. But yeah, man, really, it was just kind of it just happened by chance, you know, luck of the stars that I was looking for a band to join and they needed a bass player.
Gotcha. Obviously you have a legacy behind you. Some people like talking about these things. Other people get pissed off when I bring it up. but my only question regarding this is, how young were you when you realized you wanted to continue that legacy?
I believe I was probably 10 years old.
Okay.
You know, for most of my life growing up, my dad was at home. He wasn't on the road or anything. So I wasn't used to being, to seeing road life. But when I was 10 years old, I remember my dad sat me down and taught me some AC/DC. And that was the very first moment where I knew, like, hey, I want to do something like this. I want to be like those guys. And then a few years after that, we went on my dad did a reunion tour with Accept. I think this was in 05. Mm-hmm. And that was a tour that I got to jump on with him, and you know, me and the rest of the family went with him over the summer, and seeing that kind of change within my dad, you know, seeing him go from just the, hey, he's the guy who mows the lawn, now he's the guy up there on center of the stage in front of a packed out crowd.
Right.
Seeing that, I was like, okay, this is really now what I want to do.
Gotcha. Wow. That's awesome. And it's funny because, a lot of people won't get into that detail. Like they won't tell you, you know, dad, rock star,
right?
You know, bring some of these topics up and for some people, they want to be too cool to kind of explain that other side of it. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. I've never, you know, while other people sometimes do, I've never seen him really as a rock star. He's always just going to be my dad.
Right.
So, you know.
Gotcha. You guys have done covers over the years and you guys have always managed to make covers Howling Giant songs.
Yeah,
I'm assuming that's always purposefully done. Are there ever times where a cover is, I mean, first of all, I don't know if the covers are suggested to you guys or you guys just come up with them or decide to do them. And my other question is, has there ever been a case where someone has wanted you guys to cover something, but wanted you guys to be 100% faithful to the original as opposed to what you normally do with covers?
I mean, when we've approached covers, I guess to answer that second question first, usually we're asked to do a cover of like, you know, a band off a certain record. Really, it's been through Magnetic Eye Records doing their Redux program stuff.
Right.
So they might say, like, what are three potential songs you'd like to do off this? Like, what are your top three you'd be open to doing? And sometimes, you know, one of the guys from the label, Jad, might suggest one that he thinks we would be good for.
Mm-hmm.
So typically that's how it comes about. I mean, each one, I guess, kind of has its own story. The first cover we ever did for a Redux was Matilda Mother, Pink Floyd, kind of a deep cut. They were doing like, I forget, was it The Wall that they were originally doing? Mm-hmm. But then they wanted to like include a companion, like greatest hits of Pink Floyd.
Right.
And they just wanted bands to suggest anything. So for that one, I don't think Seabass, you weren't in the band yet for that cover.
I was not. No.
Me and Zach, I think, sat down and said, well, we want to pick a more obscure track, one that we can kind of drastically alter, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
When you're trying to decide what to do with a cover, in my opinion, it's always good to look at the song and try to find out like the identity of the song. What's like the most important part? Sometimes that's going to be like a vocal melody. Sometimes it's an iconic like riff. Sometimes it's the, you know, I mean, the lyrics are going to stay the same. But I think it's like if we're going to keep the vocal melody the same, what can we do to the chords and the like actual arrangement underneath it to change it? Mm-hmm. Like, I want to change an element and I want to retain an element. And then I want to put our own tone and like amps and kind of flavor. So to me, that's the way you contribute something without being so drastically different that it doesn't sound anything like it. Mm-hmm. I guess the best example of like that would probably be Rooster. The right. vocal melodies are going to stay the same, but I came up with that guitar riff over the chorus, right. which was like just completely, you know, my creation at the time and us as a band saying, okay, well, this is like something we would write for Howling Giant. If you took the melody away, we could use this as a chorus for something. You know what I mean? Kind of loosely follows the chords, but distinctly has a Howling Giant kind of flavor. So I guess that's kind of the quote unquote formula. If okay. you try to just stay true to a song, there's almost like, why did you cover it? Especially when it's, you know, a lot of these iconic tracks. It's like, what can you contribute? Right, right. You know what I mean? It's, you know, you got to do something also, weird with it.
Mm-hmm. I also don't feel like we've ever been, you know, pressured by anybody in any way to cover something and keep it super, super faithful. I feel like when people are asking us for covers, they kind of know that we're going to put our own spin on it and they respect that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we've never really got that question of like, hey, I want you guys to do this song, but like do it exactly like the original.
I think one moment that like when we did that cover of Balls or not Balls to the Wall, what do we do with your dad?
Shoot to Thrill.
Shoot to thrill. When we did Shoot to Thrill, I remember what was that? Was it Blabbermouth where they were like kind of like there were these old heads that were like upset that we had like changed the song. And to me, it was like,
gonna be that.
I was like, dude, you guys already have Shoot to Thrill. Like you already right. have the AC/DC version. This is like yeah. This is the spin on it. And you don't have to like it, but like there's no point if we just tried to copy it exactly, you know?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you guys. I mean, you've got on the one side, where as you said, Tom, where a band covers a track and you're like, really? No one's ever going to listen to that because the original is so iconic.
Man.
And then if they do it exactly like the original, it's like you've just shot yourself twice in the foot.
Man, exactly. I think another great example is like Johnny Cash covering Hurt. You know, it's right. like being able to take that song and retain the melody and the lyrics, obviously, but to like put it in such a completely different like setting and tone where all of a sudden, like it's the message changes because the speaker has changed. The delivery is completely changed. That's a perfect example of, you know, you have to retain something and you have to alter something or else there's no point to having done yeah. the cover, you know,
to the point where you have concert reviewers saying for some reason, Trent Reznor decided to cover Johnny Cash's Hurt. No, it's
yeah.
just.
yeah, man.
Yeah.
Yep. That's going to happen. It's an iconic cover, you know, it's going to happen.
Have there been any covers that have been or bands that have been suggested that you guys cover that you guys just weren't into and decided not to go after it? I mean, you don't have to name the band.
Yeah, go on.
No, I was just going to say we passed up the NSYNC and Backstreet Boys covers.
That's not true. I would have said yes. I would have said we're doing this. No, we were offered a Nine Inch Nails cover, I think, mm-hmm. at some point. And we were considering doing it because we had a different member at the time who was a big fan. But I think ultimately we decided not to do it just because we had done so many covers. And at least for me, you know, there wasn't as much of like the personal connection.
Right.
To, I mean, all the respect in the world for the band, but there is a certain amount of like connection I think you want to have to something to be able to put your spin on it. And so I think that one was passed, but not for any real strong reason. It was just kind of that really. I'm trying to think if there's anything else we were like, There was never a moment where we put our foot down and said, no, like, we're not doing this. We're drawing the line here. It was always kind of like a soft, no, we've done too many covers. But if you really push us, we will do one, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that makes sense. I mean, if you're going to record something, it should speak to you. You should have some sort of a connection. You know, if down the road you guys decide, hey, let's pull this one out of the show, or let's do this for this tour, you know, all right, well, we've already covered this band on this album, or, you know, whatever. So it wouldn't be that difficult to just rehearse it and do it for this tour, you know, as opposed to, okay, yeah, we'll do it. You know,
yeah. you want to enjoy it. You want to feel like pulled to do something. You know what I mean? It's still a contribution to art. And so you don't want to just phone it in. You know, it's like you want to be stoked about it. One that we were working on just for us for fun, that we used to do Working Man by Rush just in our practice room for like these live streams. We never tracked it for anything. And I don't think we really changed that much. It was a distinctly different flavor because we were using quite a bit more gain at the time, you know, than like Rush would have been using. But that's a song that's just fun to play, you know. Almost, I think we wouldn't necessarily record a version unless we were able to come up with something different enough where it felt like we were contributing something. But it was still worth covering because it was fun and the riff was sick. And sometimes in a live setting, that's all you need. Right. So there's kind of a distinction between like recording something and just playing something live because familiarity is good at a show. You know, we play Godzilla and we cut out the bridge. We changed the bridge section quite a bit, but realistically it's like, man, that riff is just fun to play. And being able to like give the audience kind of a lifeline to say, like, if you're new to us and you don't know anything about us, having at least one moment where it's like, this is a good reference point. If you like this and if you like this spin on it, that's a good lens through which to look at Howling Giant's catalog.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Cool. One of the other tracks that you guys have covered is Lord of This World from Black Sabbath. Obviously, we lost Ozzy earlier this year. Mm-hmm. Can you guys give me a favorite Ozzy or Sabbath moment?
Man, that's so tough for me. Because there are so many different moments where really Ozzy, I guess Black Sabbath, but like Ozzy has popped in kind of as like a vocal influence in a way. My voice isn't necessarily Ozzy-ish, but it is like this guy who's singing about kind of just whatever he wants. I don't know. It's like some songs are goofy, but some songs are like heavy. Some songs are dark. He manages to turn on this like these like heart pull moments of like, mama, I'm coming home and stuff like that. And there's just this, like, I don't know. He really felt like he pursued the things he wanted to do. You can write Iron Man, you can write, you know, Lord of This World and just explore whatever whim you want to. And people are going to respect you as like this honest kind of, that's Ozzy. That's what Ozzy's going to do.
Right.
Maybe that was a rambling response, but there's just like so much respect for, I guess, his image and his approach to his work throughout his career. That's just like, man, I hope someday to have an impact, even like a fraction of what Ozzy had, you know. It was amazing.
I think that, you know, Ozzy is, while still being a celebrity and whatnot, you know, in the end, he always stayed true to his guns and, you know, loved, you know, lived and loved rock and roll. And yeah, he was just so influential and his energy that he had was so amazing. But I mean, even up to his very last day with him basically saying that he was holding on for that last concert, that just goes to show you what that music and the fans really meant to him. And for me, that's really inspirational.
I remember in like middle school, I had a friend who learned the Crazy Train riff. And that was like a moment of like this hybrid kind of somewhere in between rock and metal kind of flavor that I was like, man, that's like what a riff is supposed to be. Right. So like almost from less Ozzy, I guess, but more the guitar side of that, I was like, it can have major moments. You know what I mean? It can have this riff that is just so impactful. And then to have his vocals come in over the top, it's like that mix of major and minor kind of approach is something that I love. I just distinctly remember that my buddy coming in and being like, check this riff out. And that just like changed me, man. It was awesome.
Cool. All right. So Crucible and Ruin will be coming out on the day this interview is released. Where can people go to pick up the album? Not stream it, but pick it up to ensure that the most amount of money gets back into you guys' pockets.
Yeah, man, Bandcamp is the best way. If you look up Howling Giant on Bandcamp, you know, we will package that and ship it out to you. And if you ask us, you know, we're happy to sign the top if you want. You know, we'll include these. We have some lyric books we've been printing at home, which are really cool. We might make a few more of those. We'll see. Mm-hmm. Those were for the deluxe, I think, the pre-orders. But yeah, Bandcamp is the best way. Otherwise, come out to a show. If we're coming through near you, you know, we're going to be out on the road all November. So check the dates and come on out. We'll hook it up.
Okay. As far as checking out the dates, where should people go to keep up with you guys?
You can hit all of our social media. We're on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, X, you know, pretty much, you know, YouTube, anything you think of, we're on it. So yeah, we keep that updated pretty much every single day. And so, yeah, we're always posting dates on there. So go ahead and check them out.
Awesome. I want to thank the two of you guys for spending some time with me today to discuss the album and discuss the band. And really look forward to having people check the album out. Like I said, I've gotten a chance to listen to it and really enjoyed it. So I hope everyone else does as well.
Awesome. Thank you, Victor. Thanks for having us, man. Right. I appreciate
you. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you, guys. See you.
Cheers.
Subscribe to the show on all your favorite podcast platforms like Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon, and more. Go to signalsfrommars.com for more information. This concludes our show.